It's now time to think outside the box of what we've always known.
I myself will tend my sheep and have them lie down, declares the sovereign Lord.
I think that's a profound turning point in somebody's relationship with God.
And our hope in starting this was that this would become an ever-expanding conversation.
Just two real guys talking about life. That's a nice tagline.
Well, I'm Wayne Jacobson.
And I'm Brad Cummings.
And welcome to another edition of The God Journey. God Journey.
We're back at The God Journey.
We're always back.
I know, but I don't know how to do the intro differently. We're back.
I'm back from New England.
Well, good for you. How's New England?
And an April 1st snowstorm. And
just, that's all good.
Yeah, it was all good. Saw lots of old friends, met some wonderful new people, and that was a great trip. It was a fun trip, and I met Leroy.
Leroy. I didn't know you knew any Leroys.
Well, you know I'm a dog lover, so I'm staying in this home. Last place I stayed in New England, up in Concord, and I look out the window, and there's a big dog in the backyard. I'm going, I really got a dog. And he said, well, sort of. I said, what do you mean, well, sort of? And the story behind the dog is,
what it is,
you can't get near it. You just can't get within 10 feet of it. It'll run off. It's
skittish?
Not skittish.
Or,
it's an escapee from the nearby SPCA. I guess he was chained to a pole and broke the chain, and he ran off into the woods near there.
SPCA, I'm sorry.
Society for Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. You know, the dog pound.
Oh.
He's the escapee.
I could have got the dog pound like that.
Oh, I like to use fancy high-class terminology so listeners feel alienated from the podcast.
I just haven't memorized all the acronyms out there.
Oh, well, that's the big acronym for dog lovers. Anyway, so they went and they spent a few days out there trying to trap it. They put a big cage out there with a door that would trip and food in it. He won't go in anything. He won't go near it.
Don't blame him.
I don't either. They've been able to capture this dog. So he lives outside their house, and they take food out to this little lean-to thing, and they put food in there for him. But they got to put it right on the edge. He will not lean into the lean-to to get his food.
Well, yeah, he's thinking
somebody's going to hook him. And
there you go.
And what was sad, Sunday when I got up, he's laying outside in the grass, dried grass, still winter back there. He's laying in the grass looking at the house longingly. And I thought, you know, this is like
a lot of believers.
Well, the whole deal between, you know, I've broken free of religion. I've got out of the SPCA. I'm tired of...
Oh, my gosh.
In fact, he still has the collar on. They were able to get the chain off. He still has the collar on from the SPCA and the chain broke when he ran away. And no one can even get close to him. And even when the guy who's Dave, whose home I was staying in, his little prayer tent set up, he's got a little prayer canopy set out in the woods. He'll walk out there and the dog will walk 25 feet behind him. And then lay outside and watch him. You know, these, you know, tented little pavilion things with this mosquito net thing around it. So he can just go out there and spend time reading and praying. And the dog will watch him. And then as soon as he comes out of the tent, the dog backs way away. And then when he walks back to the house, the dog will get behind him again and come around. This dog is dying to be loved. But it can't overcome its fear of being abused to find his way to that love. And I think it's just an amazing
little
story.
There's a whole bunch of Leroys out there.
There are. Here's a guy. Here's a dog, and I love dogs. I'd go out and pet him today if I could. And he won't anybody touch him. Won't anybody get near him. And Dave's finally gotten able to have hot dogs in his hands and hold his hand down like that, and the dog will come and eat out of his hand. But if he turns his hand over to try and pet the dog or reach to the dog, it takes off.
Yeah, I would.
Can't figure out how to be loved. I thought, gosh, I know a lot of people like that. I really do. They've been burned, sure. They've been captive. They've been angry. They're all that. And now they're just so afraid of love. And they wanted just to watch this dog look at the house. It just broke my heart. I mean, lots of people getting together there and lots of stuff going on. He's looking at the house like, man, I'd love to get in there, but I can't do it. I cannot do it. I cannot overcome my fear. Man, it was quite a story, quite a paradox.
Wow. That's quite a telling picture. Yeah. Leroy.
Leroy the dog.
I know a bunch of Leroy Christians.
Yeah, I do too.
And I don't, you know, I think that the thing is, you know, I think one of the most valuable skills you could ever acquire on this planet, genuine forgiveness. I think a lot of people give lip service to it, but I don't know that it really transacts fully in the heart. I think that's why you have a bunch of people that they're longing for something, but they can't go near it.
So you still live reactively, don't you? You still, instead of being able to embrace what life brings to you, you're so reactive to what people might do to me that I can't find the genuine.
It's weird. Fear of disappointment or the fear of rejection, it's almost like those become self-fulfilling prophecies, because the guarded way in which you behave that you're not aware of. You're just protecting yourself.
Right.
But you have no idea. It's like if you were to hold up a hand in front of someone's face and try to have a conversation. It doesn't feel that way to the other person. You know, I'm just protecting myself. Well, I get that. But it really looks like you're stiff-arming the other person. So they end up going, I'm not interested. I don't feel like I can connect. I'm not allowed in. And I know the person's doing it for protection, but it ends up inviting rejection. And then the person is further cemented in their fears, like, see, I know it's going to turn out that way.
Yeah.
And you just go like, that cycle is such a prison, an entrapment of disappointment.
Well, it's hard because inside that person, it looks like they're making the wisest decision possible. Why get hurt again? Why get, you know, whatever? And so I'm going to really check things out. But like you say, it is a stiff arm, and people just finally give up trying to find their way into that. And the person ends up, as you said, reinforced in their own bondage and pain. And poor Leroy, he's got people around that would really love him. And they would even say, we'd love to have a dog we could have in our house. This dog could be inside by the fire loving up on a family.
Right.
And it can't figure out how to overcome its fear enough because somebody abused the heck out of it.
Right.
And I guess I'm going to go back to talk to Leroy and talk to him about forgiveness. That'd be cool.
No, but I mean, I think the whole dynamic, I don't think we really understand that what an absolute supernatural thing forgiveness really is. Because you're giving for. It's like, you know what? This isn't fair. If you try to figure out fair, I'm sorry, you're never going to make that transaction. If you try to figure out who's right, again, I'm pretty sure you're never going to make that transaction. Forgiveness to me is something that has nothing to do with fair or right. It's the fact that there's a broken situation. And unless somebody gives for that moment, what it doesn't have, it won't get solved. And it's like the only person that can put that in my heart, that's God. And if I can't, if I find myself bankrupt, well, blessed are you. You know, the whole spiritually impoverished. It's like, okay, great. God, I need something that you can give to me, that I can give in this situation that will change the tit-for-tat dynamics, because that will never heal itself. And that keeps people, I think, imprisoned in their loneliness.
Yeah. And it's sad. It's just so sad to watch it.
Because, I mean, there's nothing you're going to say or do that's going to logic them out of that place.
Right.
It's that unless they get touched in their heart with a sense that says, you know what, you can't keep yourself safe, and I can't give you a promise that you won't get burned. I just can't. But I can tell you that there's someone who will walk with you that won't abandon you in that process. And that's not a human being. That is the living God.
And that doesn't diminish our ability to love people out of those places. We can if we are patient and hang in there over the long haul with somebody that's all locked up inside. We actually did it with a pup a long time ago. I wrote about it, and he loves me. We had this stray pup show up at our house. And
Leroy Jr.
It wouldn't even come eat. It was a puppy. It had not had this history that, you know, had. But it took probably 10, 12 days for us to put food out, coax it, get closer to it, finally be able to break through this dog's fear of abuse and isolation, whatever. So I do think there's ways that people who, and I think that's the whole incarnational love of God, was to show up in your language and give into people who had created no end of pain for God and his creation. He comes to love people out of the dark places where they got lost. And so, yeah, I think we can represent that to some degree in people's lives that we're around. I mean, just have enough patience and love someone long enough and kind of coax them out of the darkness. We've had some wonderful relationships with people where Sarah and I have been able to do that, but they're not easy. They're not like, have you over for the evening and we'll have it all fixed by the time we're done.
Have you over for the next year. You ever see the movie A Horse Whisperer?
Yeah, a long time ago.
See, I thought there was a beautiful picture of Robert Redford just standing in that field. And he didn't approach the horse. He just stood in the field. And, you know, it's a montage that happens over quite a bit of period of time, but slowly that horse comes to it. I really sort of feel like that's the posture of love that just says, I'm here. I'm not going to try to fix you. I'm not necessarily going to coax you, but I'm just here. And I think a lot of times God really is there if we would let him. But it's a question of he's not going to jump on your back and try to ride you. He knows that that's not going to work. So he's just going to stand. But he's available. And the question is, what is it that you really want? Because, you know, when you find a Leroy or you find someone that's hurt and broken and it's like, well, you know, they could be inside. Well, that isn't what they want because that's not what they're doing. I don't know what it is that they really want. Something in them may want that, but it isn't enough because they're choosing in their pain to say, I'd sooner have this.
But how aggressive is that choosing? How much is that just reactive pain? I can't choose otherwise. I think that's what a lot of people feel.
Yeah, I mean, in a dog, I don't know. In a person.
Let's talk about people.
Yeah, in a person.
this is not the dog journey.
Well, for dyslexia, it's your dog journey. You know, I think for people, I recognize people can be victimized, but the moment that you choose in your identity to be a victim, golly, that prison is locked on the inside.
You see that as an overt choice, though? I'm not sure I do.
I do.
I'm not sure somebody says, what, I'd like to be locked in my pain.
I may be bitter and unkind, but okay.
That's a big leap.
But I do, because I sort of end up going like, who on the planet hasn't been hurt? I mean, I sort of feel like, you know, I recognize there's awful things that are perpetrated. But even then, there is still, if that person no longer has any volitional ability, then I don't have any hope for any of this.
And I don't mean that. I don't really mean they don't have the volitional ability to choose to go beyond where they're hurting. But without the opportunity to, and I'm just reacting in my pain, and I don't know what else to do, and I've never had enough love in my life to give me any hope that somebody's going to come into it. I do think we always have the volition to move out of where we are, which is different to me than at some point back there, I just said, you know what? Life's too painful. I'm going to live in my closet.
Yeah, but I mean, I guess for me, I look at the fact that, look, I don't know if Robert Redford's ever going to stand in my wounded field, but God is. God's never left that moment.
Absolutely.
God is profoundly there available to me. And even the most abused, wounded, outcast of a person, God's still standing in their field. I don't know about other human beings. I cannot promise them that anybody on the planet is behaving correctly or kindly. But God is there and can be known and will make himself known to that hurting heart. I just that's my own life experience. That is what I have encouraged others with, and it's like, I cannot promise you how other human beings will behave, but there is one guy that will not burn you.
I agree, but I think it's that what you're talking about now is the kind of hope that people who are lost in the darkness need to at least, and I don't need to believe it necessarily at the very beginning, but you at least have to
field.
You've talked about it a lot, at least suspend your disbelief long enough to go, maybe he is there and maybe he isn't what I thought he would be, and maybe he didn't. And I think a lot of people, no matter what pain other people have caused them, unfortunately, they've always got God behind the scenes pulling the rope. You know, God gave me a rotten family. God gave me a rotten spouse. God gave me a rotten business partner. God gave me, and it always, the blame is so Godward to reactive people.
Oh, yeah.
That the idea of him standing in my field is not comforting at all. Get out of my freaking field.
No, I know. I mean, I think the fruit of where I'm at emotionally in this is the fruit of God doing something in the midst of my own kind of pain. There was one moment where it had hit its breaking point for my little life. And, you know, whatever that is, I sort of feel like that's where comparison is kind of stupid. For someone, that may be a much lesser thing than you. For someone else, it might be a much greater thing. But for me, it was my absolute breaking point where it was like, God, I don't believe that verse that says you'll never leave me nor forsake me. I don't believe that's true. I feel left. I feel forsaken. And it's personal. I'm not blaming human beings anymore. I am going after you. And in the moment, it's like God replayed a bunch of the more painful moments in my life, and he showed me where he was. And it was a shock and a surprise, because I could have guaranteed you the way it emotionally registered for me, he was not there. So now he's giving me this insertion of a picture that says he is there. And I'm going like, I don't remember that. I didn't feel that. And each of those moments very clearly said, Brad, I was right there. You didn't ask. I was right behind you. You didn't look. And in those moments that he picked, he was absolutely right. I did not have something to gainsay that moment. And it instructed me in a way that nothing else I think would have. I realized, gosh, in my pain, I do become blind to his presence a lot. And I consider it his absence. And I just conclude it that way. And that breaks relationship between me and him.
Yeah, and I honestly think that's the nature of sin. I think the nature of sin, and I think you see that in the Old Testament. Very quickly it went from, when you look at the early fallen folks, very early it went from we've sinned and broken faith with God to God's a creep. God's a big angry bully.
Yeah.
God's a creep.
He did this.
And so and I think it took till Jesus could actually come and show us, no, God isn't like what you think he is. He's not even close to that. But in our sense of shame, and I think the darkness of sin and all that retreating we do, even Jesus on the cross, when he's inside all that pain and he's inside all that sense of shame, he thinks God has forsaken. He deals with that, my God, why have you forsaken me? And we can all say, no, he didn't. But in the reality of the darkness of sin, I really do feel like, and that's almost true in any, you see, relationships between brothers, and I've watched enough of these over my 58 years. You watch brothers get broken, and there's never the humility that says, gosh, maybe we miscommunicate. Maybe No. I'm absolutely right, and you're a creep. And the more they talk about it, the more creepy the other person has to be to justify them being right. And sin has this incredible capacity to put us in the darkness. But I don't think in the darkness necessarily the choices, I don't know that they're overt choices other than we're just reacting to stuff. And I think the incarnation, God, we're talking about God making himself known to us, standing in our field, whatever. God's coaxing us into a life of love and a life of relationship and responding to him rather than being reactive to the world and the way we've been hurt and what creepy people do to you, because creepy people will do creepy stuff. That's just true. I think you're right. Yeah. You promise that won't happen. Not everybody had loving parents. Not everybody had faithful fathers or faithful spouses. Life hurts. But God's in it as the Redeemer. And what if I was living with Leroy, I tell you what, I'd be out there every day. I would consider it the rest of my life's mission to work my way into that dog's heart and give it a home. And I think it's that passion that brings Jesus here in the incarnation. There's a place for you in my Father's house. You can live out there in the snow and yeah, I'll still feed you because I love you. I'm going to take care of some of your needs because I'm not going to see you starve to death. But you have an entire home filled with warmth and joy and love. Somehow you've got to crawl out of that reactive stuff enough to stand there and let God approach you and not run away like a scared. And I know it's tough. We got a letter from a listener in Canada, didn't identify their name, but in the Addicted to Sin podcast said this. One thing I wanted to mention about addiction, if addiction truly does exist, is that no matter how much we despise the sin, when someone is addicted, they continue with the sin. I'm sure there are millions of people out there who would like to leave sin behind because they see the destructive consequences of it in their lives, but they still can't get out. What advice do you have for someone like that? How can a double-minded man, unstable in all his ways, learn to walk in righteousness that he truly desires? I think there'll be a lot of people when I read that go, yes, please help. And I think what we talked about for the last 10 minutes is part of that. It's you've got to suspend your disbelief that, you know, God's not big enough to meet you in the midst of your sin and help you walk out. And
it's not self-effort, and it's not, I mean, I think one of the biggest challenges is you mentioned Jesus on the cross dealing with that sense of abandonment. I think most people go like, well, yeah, see, he does abandon you. I don't think they sit back and go, oh, Jesus was feeling something. I think they hear that as doctrine. Your sin? God can't look on sin.
Right.
I mean, isn't that the little mantra that it's like, well, if he can't look on sin, he's not in this universe.
Absolutely. And he's certainly not with me in my pain.
And he wasn't in Christ reconciling the world. It's like, wait a minute.
Well, even going back to what you said about forgiveness, what we were taught about forgiveness was because we come to God through Jesus Christ, God no longer sees the real us. He sees this pristine, perfect. And it's like God needs to see us pristine and perfect.
Because he couldn't forgive you the who you are.
Or he couldn't be in the same room with you.
Yeah.
And I think what the New Testament teaches, until you let God into your sin, you have no hope of getting out of it. I mean, God has got to come where I'm stupid, reactive, broken, indulgent. And if I can't meet him there so that he can walk me out, then it is just self-effort. And we're told self-effort doesn't work.
See, I sort of feel like, again, I don't have the definitive answer on anything. But for the double-minded man stuck in an addiction that really is desiring something different, I think there needs to be a place of for real honesty with the double-mindedness that says, hey, God, guess what? As opposed to pretending I'm a victim stuck in my addiction, I like it. And I haven't seen something better that gives me an option that I think is worth choosing other than what I do get out of this. I get some. I mean, if an addict had that kind of honest conversation about what it is that there's there, and there is the real heart's cry for forgiveness, I totally believe in the inability of the human soul to free itself. I do.
Yeah.
Okay, so yes, valid, stuck, can't be rescued on its own, but God can, and God will not ignore the true heart's cry for deliverance. I just think there's a lot of people that want to see a lot of others free, that they want that freedom more than the person that's stuck in their stuff does. I mean, I'm not unaware of addiction. I got a whole bunch of experience with family and everything else that has a whole bunch of, oh my gosh.
Oh, I thought you were going to tell me about your meth habit.
Well, no, not yet. I'm not ready to come out of the closet on that one.
Okay.
But I look at that and it's like, do I have patient long? Yeah, I'm talking 30, 40 years of stuff. And do I think people will change? Well, gosh, after six, at times I dare say precious little. But I do know that in that moment where someone really comes to that place of broken honesty before God, I just think that requires a lot of courage. And a lot of people have been shaped in a way that they just kind of go like, well, I don't think God will meet me there. And that's their fears. That's the Leroy place where it's like, no, I'm not going to go and have that conversation.
And that's what they need is a better gospel, that you can have that conversation with God. God just doesn't turn his back on you because you're lost in sin. And that's what religion has taught for 2,000 years. You can't, God won't. You've got to make yourself better, clean yourself up, then God will bless you.
And let's also, let's pretend like we don't like our sin. Excuse me. At the end of the day, I think one of the laws of gravity and truth is that, you know what? Every person on this planet is doing exactly what they want to do. They may have 1,000 reasons for why that's not the case, but at the end of it, it is, no, you may be afraid of something else so you feel stuck in this, but you're still choosing that. And that's where I kind of feel like, I don't think God's going to be an unjustified judge of every act, word, and deed, you know, every thought, intent of our heart. I'm going like, you know, I think we're on the hook for all of that stuff. That doesn't make me frightened, and that doesn't like, ooh, judgment gospel. It's more like, you know what? I just think that's the empowered place of human beings and the incredible human will he's given us. God will not violate my choosing, even to the point that if I say, God, I don't want anything to do with you and your kingdom forever. And it's like, well, there's only one real option for you to go then at the end of eternity. And God isn't there like, no, I'm not going to let that happen. I think he doesn't want that, but he doesn't impose his will like we would if we were God.
Yeah, no kidding. And we just, even for people's own good, we would impose our will on them.
Oh, yeah. Well, and I think we do that all the time.
Yeah, and God seems to know a whole lot better than that. This question is not unrelated to a discussion, and it kind of goes back to Renee's story when she was with us, and he says, He said, you know, Renee was raised in a Bible-believing environment, so thus far she's going to be conflicted about her homosexuality. I said, what about a person who's never brought up with the Bible, had no faith, had no faith relationship with God, and the conflict isn't between right and wrong as much as feeling confused and different, not fitting in with the rest of the world. After going through puberty, approaching adulthood, that person comes to a sort of realization that they've never had a natural attraction to the opposite sex. They may have even tried to force themselves into a dating situation, or some even marriage, but to no avail. It just doesn't fit. Who knows why or how they got to this place? Eventually, they conclude that they're only attracted to the same sex. So how do you approach this situation? Romans 1 doesn't seem to apply. Comparing this person to a drug addict or alcoholic doesn't make sense. Got any thoughts for Chris? Who I'm sure is asking for a friend.
you know, again, it's like I think I'm back to a fundamental assumption I have. God is not void from that moment. And whether they were raised with Bible or clarity or anything, Romans does talk about just the very existence of creation as being a very real apologetic for the reality of God. That truth comes screamingly clear and has to then sort of be pushed away, repressed.
Yeah.
And so I end up going like, you know what? The scenario, well, you know, what if I'm under a rock that's too heavy for God to you know what? Just because I can put that scenario in language, I don't think that person's void of God and a God awareness. The question is, what are they doing with that? That's how I would sort of approach that whole bit, is like, as opposed to trying to make them feel guilty about whatever. I'd approach it really from a relational standpoint of just saying, hey, where are you at? I think good meaning religious people are trying to help the world out of the sin it doesn't really recognize.
Yeah, we'll give you moral code. You're violating it. The world's highest authority. You
gotta
stop.
I got the good news for you, brother. Like, dude, there's no good news in that.
Well, even what he writes about the person he's talking about, there seems to be something inside them that says, this isn't natural. I don't fit in. And it's not just comparing yourself to other people. I do think the sense of brokenness in our lives and the sin that comes from it isn't something we've got to find all the moral codes to and see, gosh, is this or is this not right or wrong? I think it's shame is intuitive internally until Jesus removes it in the cross. And so I think people like that, at least most I've talked to, as hard as they may be trying to justify it on the outside, on the inside, they really do feel unsettled. Many are suicidal. And yeah, they want to blame the culture for that, because we lift up heterosexuality in our culture so much. We need to make gays okay, more of this thing, so these people don't. I don't know if that changes anything. I think the internal sense of disconnect in our spirit is greater even than our religious training growing up.
Yeah.
Both for truth and in error.
And I don't think that is just societal tradition being imposed from the outside, or, you know, just the judgmentalness of religious people. I've met plenty of folks that, hey, they didn't have anyone else declaring or decrying them on their own. They just felt stuck, and they weren't at peace with it. And as much as they might try to justify their life and actions, they're not convincing the most important person, themselves. You know?
Yeah.
It's like, I don't need to step into the bear trap of all, well, you're just coming at me with judgment. It's like, I'm not coming at you at all.
Yeah.
That's not me. That's inside you. The good news to those people, I think, is that, gosh, I don't know how you actually find change apart from God.
Yeah.
For me, the best news is the fact that change is possible.
Yeah, and the fact that they may not know what they're doing, you know, violates the nature of how God made them to be. But the fact that they're lost in something like that says they don't know the Father I know. And it really is to introduce them to the Father. It really isn't to show you how wrong your sin is. You let somebody get near God. God has a great way of bringing people to the end of themselves, showing them what's in their life that's causing them pain and destruction, and righting whatever was twisted by sin for them to end up where they've ended up. That all comes out of a relationship with Father. So instead of trying, like this was real prevalent 10 years ago among many of the evangelical movement, we've got to convince the world of law before we can give them grace.
And then they'll love grace so much more because they'll now have a deeper appreciation for what a great thing it is.
Yeah, because God isn't endearing enough. Knowing him wouldn't win me out of these places where people get stuck and lost.
See, I think that...
Even if they don't know they're lost yet.
The tragedy of that approach is that they may ultimately, in spite of you, discover the goodness of God, but then they have the issue of you. And I've had people respond, if those people are going to be in heaven, I don't want to go. Just like, oh, I am sympathetic. I would still say we're all deficient of a revelation of Father, but
yeah,
I think it's a travesty that we, in the name of trying to present the good news, the gospel, that we heap just so much bad news and judgment. I'm just going like, I don't really read that in the Gospels. I don't see Jesus' approach to sinners. I see if Jesus ever got like real firm and hard, it's really on the self-righteous. It wasn't on the broken. He was dinged for hanging out with those people, and they seem to enjoy his presence.
Well, as I've often said, I think self-righteousness is always worse than unrighteousness, especially in how obnoxious it makes you. And I think that's why people get really turned off to the whole religion thing when it's just, we're going to win you by law and here's truth and you're doing wrong and we got to change you and all that stuff. People just, because that's really obnoxious. A person being indulgent in sin might be painful and might do really stupid things, but they're not nearly as obnoxious as that goody, sweet religious person who just can't wait to put you under the law and push you around until you're not good enough and you need to do better. And it doesn't make God engaging. And so on both sides of that, you got people say, well, I don't want to do that. There's people I wouldn't want to go to heaven with who claim they've got the ultimate pass to heaven. And there's people in the world that are more fun to hang out with, even in their pain and hurt. And until we have people who live inside the life of Jesus in an engaging way that touch both the religiously lost and the indulgently lost, that's kind of what Jesus came to do, find them both somehow. And move them to a better place. But religion is a drug of choice to people who think their rightness makes them better than you.
And that addiction's pretty thick.
Oh, it's huge.
Because it is wrapped in such wonderfully prideful strokes of, oh.
And such feelings of, man, I'm doing
sincere
great.
Sincere passion.
I'm fine. Yeah. And that kind of what feeds into this Civil War letter. I don't know if you want to take this thing on. Somebody sent us this thing you said you want to talk about a little bit, maybe?
You know, I think what, I forget who sent this, but it was one of those sort of new takes on the Civil War. And I think I was shocked when it sort of tried to pin the whole Civil War and the reality of it on evangelical Christians.
Yeah.
I said, what? What? That's a new one.
Well, for those who haven't read this yet, draw that line for us. This is Pam Kelly in some kind of article about this historian who new take on the Civil War. Who's the historian? Oh, David Goldfield. There it is.
You know, I just my quick summary of it was I think it's the way that the religious culture handles truth. We're not content with someone else that has a differing opinion. It's almost as if we have got to be so right that we demonize our enemy and therefore justify such atrocities as war. And I'm just going like, golly, there is the sensibility in our little evangelical culture that kind of does that. We're not just, well, okay, I disagree with you. It's, if you disagree with me, you're wrong, you're of the enemy, and therefore I have a God-given mandate to set this right and kill you.
To blow you away. And the book of Acts is filled with that. It is filled with, I'm not only for Jesus, but I've been reading through, you know, Paul, whenever he threatens the whole religious, whether it's Artemis's idol makers in Ephesus or whatever, it's not enough to, I just disagree with you. It's, we got to kill you. We got to get a mob. We got to take you outside the city and beat the crud out of you. And religion's always, here's what Goldfield says. So why did America resort to war? Goldfield points to the polarized political system. Governments work best, he says, when they employ moderation and compromise. But the evangelical Christian wing of the Republican Party, and I didn't even know they exist back in 18. 1950.
That's where they're like, I don't know. That's a stretch.
Drove a wedge between Americans. He says the self-righteous poisoned the political process, making compromise impossible. Goldfield says, if you believe your opponent is not only wrong but sinful, how can you compromise?
Yeah, that's...
I think that's the point of the article. And whether that's really, I think this is a part of, I've got to try and make the Civil War fascinating in the 21st century. So I'm going to take a 21st century villain and throw him back in the 1860s and try and make it the point of war. But I think he's right. I think part of the problem we have today is you have this intransigent party or group of people that when you're right, you can't compromise with the world. You have to have it all your way or nothing at all.
Well, you know, you look at, you know, I'm not going to wax political here, but we're like a few hours away from the entire government shutting down because of this same kind of polarity of opinions. And you're just going like, we can't find anybody to have a reasonableness from either side of just saying, hey, we got to get our house in order, or guess what? We don't have a house anymore.
Yeah, we won't have to get it in order. Okay? It'll be gone.
It'll be repossessed. And you're just going like, what in the world? Why? I think it is such a challenge, and especially in a religious environment, when someone disagrees with what you consider to be true, I do think we are tempted to villainize those people, and we end up seeing them as evil and the devil, which just absolutely makes any meaningful dialogue impossible.
It makes you obnoxious.
Yeah.
Exactly. Even if you're right, even if you really know what ultimate truth might comment on this thing, the fact that you're trying to push others to it who don't see what you see and you want to live in a world that serves you.
Yeah, you're not handling the truth like the one who is the truth.
Yeah, he didn't come to be served. I want to shape all society to do what I want, but he came to serve. He came to be inside society, helping people find life. That's what makes this difficult. That's what makes passionate religious people in the political process a nightmare. And I would even say it's not so much that our politicians are that way. I think our politicians, particularly in this current thing, they're trying to figure out how to deal with the Tea Party constituency on the one side of the Republican Party and the spendthrift folks on the liberal side of the left party. They're trying to pander to that to stay in office. They don't even care about what's right or fixing the government or fixing our political house or our financial house. They really are just, okay, how do we get elected? Who do we pander to? Who do we, there's election coming up, you know, we gotta. And I don't see the integrity behind all that that says, no, there's a few voices that are speaking out now saying, we've got to do what's right, but they get drowned out so fast. And what's right is more moderate. It doesn't pander to either the extreme left or the extreme right. And that's how you build a political base in this silly country.
And I also think that it's a little bit of a straw man argument to say, well, one is religious and the other is godless. It's like, no.
Yeah.
I'm going to guarantee you both have their own self-styled religion there. Both have their creedal beliefs and their doctrinal sense of this is what is right, true, and just. And
we have the right to force our way on you.
That's... Yeah. And so it's like I just kind of think the characterization is poor on both sides. And it's like it only serves to further entrench and divide. And you're just going like, gosh, where is the sensibility of reality that just kind of says, you know what? You can't keep doing this. And so we're going to have to figure out, and we're going to have to kind of prioritize some of these things. And yeah, it's going to involve all of us. But it's like, no, you can't touch my pet stuff. No, you can't touch my, and you just go like, golly, I end up looking at this going, how convenient to just wipe away soap as evil. How convenient. But what does it accomplish? You are no closer to a solution, but oh, are you so well served in your conclusion? And it's like, okay, well, God bless you. Get a trophy for that, I guess.
Ugh. That's
but
yuck.
I think there was more to this whole thing with the Civil War, but one of the things that it is interesting to me when you watch what's happening in culture, and you see two sides in a pitted war, and you're just going like, golly, if we could only walk somewhere, not, gee, how do I walk the road of compromise, but how do you maintain a dialogue without demonizing your enemy? Because I just go like, that just leads to a cessation of any meaningful dialogue.
And how horrible war is. 620,000 American lives lost in that war. One of the points that the author makes is, for the $6.2 billion that the war cost, the nation could have freed the South's 4 million slaves, paid off their owners, given every farmer, former slave, reparation wages and 40 acres of land. You could have done all this without killing anybody. And just, war is a lousy...
Sounds like our same stimulus plan.
Oh, boy. It does get expensive.
Yeah. Well, I mean, when he asked the question, was this necessary? Golly, that's an incredible question. Only historians can ask.
Yeah.
You know, because I end up going like, I don't know. I wasn't there. I don't want to play armchair historian of saying, well, no, I know what it is. Just going like, you know what? In our own situations, can we avoid some of the pitted wars we end up in? Apparently not.
Yeah.
Apparently the human heart doesn't really seem to find the generous space to live in so as to avoid that. And it does take two.
And how to not get fully raped and pillaged if you do say, I'm willing to lay down my arms and find a way to cooperate. And the other side, because from some of the reading I've done...
Goody!
Yeah, okay.
I'm going to get you then.
We'll take it. Yeah, and I think then it was the Republic's going to be divided into two, and, you know, people felt, a passion for the slaves. But I've been in the South where people actually tell me, you know, the Civil War wasn't fought over slavery. It was over states' rights and whether we had the right to keep slaves even if the North didn't want them. And it was all about dude, you lost that war 160 years ago. Have you forgotten that?
No, I still see the trucks circling every now and then.
Yeah, I do too, unfortunately. People get hardened in their stuff. And until we find a way to live fully embracing the life of Jesus and be generous in our relationships with other people and find solutions that serve both sides, not just find solutions that make the world what I want it to be, we're going to keep doing this to each other.
Yeah, I mean, you got Jesus standing on the hill in tears over Jerusalem with a posture that I think is not dissimilar from the complex problems we have today.
Hmm.
Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, how long I would have wanted to gather you as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings. It's like, you know what? I'm pretty sure God has the wisdom to solve what we're facing. But I think it's God isn't for me and against you because I'm right and you're wrong. I mean, when Joshua encounters him, you know, whose side are you? I am the side.
I am the side you want to be on,
you know,
and it's not yours.
Well, yeah, the reality is God isn't here to take sides. He's here. And then it's a question of how do I meld myself to fit him?
How hard must it be for God to stand in the field as the horse whisperer, stand in the field knowing he's got what it takes to help lives change and people find real community with each other instead of continued bashing each other and brokenness and war, and how few people really take it, how few people turn around and say, God, what are you thinking, man? I'd really love to do this your way. And it's just...
Well, I think because he's clear-seeing, it probably isn't as hard for him as it might be for us.
Yeah.
Because I doubt he's there frustrated. I'm pretty sure he's there available and smiling.
Yeah.
And that's where it's like, I'd probably be available but irritated.
A couple lightning bolts in my hands. Yeah, something like that.
You know, I mean, I really haven't got to the place of going like, yeah, I can chill like you, Lord.
Man, and live at peace in it. Well, I'm off to Austin again, going back to help some people on this journey. And then I'm flying on to Florida to watch one of the last shuttle launches because I've been dying to see a shuttle launch. So,
well, there you go.
I'm going to go from Austin out to Florida, meet a good friend from D.C. and probably hang out with some folks around Florida. So next little bit will be fun.
Happy trails.
Thank you for traveling with us on the God Journey. You can be part of the conversation by visiting our website, thegodjourney.com.